Okay, so I hope the recording will work. So today we are going to continue with the green lineage. Last time we started with this group Viridae plantae, sometimes called Chloroplastida. And as I already showed you on this tree, it splits into two main lineages, Chlorophyta and Streptophyta. Last time I tried to introduce some more important or interesting species and members of the big group Chlorophyta. And today we are going to start Streptophyta. And we are going to remain within this group until the end of the semester, because this group, Streptophyta, already includes all land plants. So what we are going to talk about today are these basic algal lineages, and we will also have a short introduction into the plant terrestrialization, the transition to the life on land, and we are also going to talk about mosses and their relatives, which already belong to the land plants. They are the most, let's say, primitive land plants, so they are not algae anymore. Okay. This is just another tree, which also shows some estimations of time of dating of some important points in the evolution of the lineages. As I told you more times, this is always important to bear in mind that every single paper showing you a tree like this is just a hypothesis. You see many differences if you compare two different studies which show some dating of important events in the history. They can differ in hundreds of millions of years. It's really difficult to really be 100% sure what happened 1 billion years ago. But roughly, here we have the split of glaucophytes, of these three main lineages, the glaucophytes and the rest, then the rhodophytes, and then we can see the evolution of the green lineage. And as I told you, I hope last time, the split between Chlorophyta and Streptophyta, these two main green lineages, occurred around 1 billion years ago. And since this time, these lineages evolved separately. There are many hypotheses trying to explain why this happened, in which time. The important event on Earth in history is this so-called, there are different global glaciation events which appeared in a period which is in the end of Proterozoic time, called Cryogenian. There were two, three, I'm not sure about this third one, but there were two main global glaciation events, and many hypotheses try to explain the evolutionary events that appeared around this time. They connected with the global glaciation, because I don't know if you are familiar with this theory. Sometimes it's called snowball Earth, and it basically meant that the whole Earth froze, and it must have been a lot of stress for all living organisms. Somehow they managed to survive these events, definitely this event also started some new evolution when the Earth melted again. Then there was a lot of new space, new living new opportunities for life or on the new melted earth. So this started the irradiation of the individual lineages and the evolution of different new classes and so on. Yeah, this is another tree showing basically the same, probably with different dating of the events, as I showed you. Here it is in more detail, based on the chlorophytes. So these are all chlorophyta lineages or species, and here are streptophyta. And here the split of chlorophyta and streptophyta, yeah, is again almost 1 billion years ago. So yeah, we can roughly remember that the split of chlorophyta streptophyta was roughly 1 billion years ago. And this period of global glaciation, it's this one, this Cryogen. So you can see that many different lineages, even those from chlorophyta, started to radiate, to evolve immediately after this global glaciation event. So what are the main traits, let's say, that can define streptophyta and that makes them different from chlorophyta? It's difficult to say, because actually we have many lineages here, or many, let's say, the six main lineages within streptophyte algae. And if we look on many different traits, we see a big difference between the group of three basic ones and these three. Sometimes these are called ZCC clade. It's the first letter of the classes, and these are called, the more primitive ones are called KCM clade. And very often it appears that the algae from this ZCC clade are already very very similar to land plants. I mean, not morphologically, they still can look like very very simple algae, unicellular and so on. But if you look at their biochemistry, at their metabolism and so on, they already have a lot of things in common with land plants. Whereas these KCM classes are still, let's say, more primitive, or even more similar to chlorophyta. It's a great simplification as I am explaining it now, but you can remember it like this. So for example, a very typical thing that you always find in textbooks is that the difference between chlorophyta and streptophyta is in their microtubular orientation during the cell division. So in streptophytes, you prior to the cell division, they form so-called phragmoplast, and it's these lines, these are microtubules, and they are oriented in the connection of the two new nuclei, whereas in chlorophyta they have so-called phycoplast and they have the disorientation. But in fact, the phragmoplast evolved only in this ZCC clade. They are, it's not typical for all streptophytes, but only for these groups that are more similar or more relative to the land plants. And the basic groups, they still have cell division, which is similar to the way how it was in chlorophyta. So it's also it's okay if you say, for example, during the exam, the typical trait for streptophyta is the presence of phragmoplast, because most of the streptophytes do have it, like all land plants and so on. But actually, it's missing, still missing in the most basic lineages. Another thing that also applies only for the most developed streptophytes is grana. I don't know if you ever had any lectures about plant physiology and morphology and so on. It's a typical thing that you learn when learning about plant chloroplast, that the tilacoids within the chloroplast, they form these packages, or sometimes it's described like if you have coins put onto one another, so it looks like this way, and this this thing is typical for plants and also for the most developed streptophytic algae. They also have this, for example, different mechanism of photorespiration, but I think it's maybe not important to talk in detail about this here. I think it's maybe too much biochemistry for this lecture, so yeah, forget about it. Yeah, so what you maybe should remember is that if we ask you about some typical traits for Streptophyta as a whole, you can talk about the presence of phragmoplast and the presence of grana in plastids, and the rest is maybe not important now. Good, so now I'm going to talk about the individual lineages. If we don't talk about land plants, they are of course the most successful lineage, then most of all these classes are not very species rich and not that ecologically important, with the one exception of Zygnematophyceae. Maybe they have thousands of species and they are very successful group, but the rest of these classes usually does not contain many species, sometimes only one, for example. So there is a hypothesis that maybe sometimes in the past these lineages were also species rich, and maybe there were also even more lineages of Streptophyta, but they were somehow not successful during the evolution and outcompeted by other algae and organisms. So what we see now is just the rest of diversity that maybe was here millions of years ago, and this is lost for us now. This first class, which is really on the base of the streptophytic lineage, it's called Mesostigmatophyceae, and it has only one species. There is this class described for only one species, Mesostigma viride, and it's a flagellate which can even resemble you these primitive prasinophytes, these lineages within on the base on Chlorophyta, because it has also these organic scales on its surface. But in contrast to prasinophytes, Mesostigma is freshwater. Prasinophytes were typical in marine water. But still, it's interesting to see that in both Chlorophyta and Streptophyta, the basic lineages are flagellates with some organic scales covering the surface of the cell. So it can show us that maybe this is the so-called plesiomorphic trait for this lineage, that the ancestor of all these green plants was probably flagellate covered with scales. Maybe there is not important to talk more about mesostigma. The other group is called class. It's called Chlorocubophysi. It's also monotypic class, which means a class described with only one known species, Chlorocubus atmophyticus. Morphologically, it looks like many other green algae from terrestrial environments. It was isolated in some region in Alps from soil and then mosses and so on. So it's a terrestrial alga. So it's not like this mesostigma, which is strictly freshwater. This one is soil alga. So morphologically, it resembles many other, let's say, chlorophytic soil algae, that they have these packages, forming these packages covered with a lot of mucilage. It's an adaptation to the conditions with a lot of desiccation. So the morphology reflects the adaptation to the life in soil or in environment where they can have this desiccation stress. So morphologically, you would not think it's something so special, but when they sequenced, they found out this is not relative to anything closely relative. So it's a new class within streptophytes. Another class, maybe a little more interesting because it already has more species, is the class Clepsomediophysi. In Clepsomediophysi, we find filamentous algae, mostly from the genus Clepsomedium. And the genus Clepsomedium, they all look basically the same. You see no real morphological variation in many Clepsomedium, but this is like phylogenetic tree of many isolates from different places in the world, and you see that genetically it's very diversified. It's difficult to describe the species morphologically, but still it's not genetically the same. And it's one of the most common soil algae, so you would find it, or terrestrial algae, so you would find it on soil and wood and concrete and different aeroterrestrial places. And one of the keys of its success in these terrestrial environments is that they are really very well desiccation tolerant. One of the things that helps them to be so desiccation tolerant is the special composition of their cell walls. They contain a polysaccharide callose, which helps them to be really flexible. So when they desiccate, they just shrink and they don't collapse, they don't break, they are so flexible. Even the cell walls are not rigid but flexible, and after rehydration they can just survive normally. This tree also shows not just genetic diversity but also occurrence on different substrates. What is blue color? It's the freshwater. So they have also many members that live not just on soil, but they can be found really in water. Those that are yellow are from terrestrial environment, but natural, something like rock or wood. And the red lineages are from some artificial substrates, like concrete and some statues and churches and things like that. And the authors of this paper basically found quite an interesting thing, that there is no biogeography within the genus Klebsormedium. So that individual lineages, the individual members of the lineages, can be found all over the world. But what is important for them is the ecology, which means, for example, that you see that all the, here in this lineage, all are, most of them are yellow, most of them are red. Here, most of them are blue, like fresh water. So it means that for them, the biogeography is not not a real limit, that they can be by air or by birds, they can be transported all over the world, but they are connected with a particular environment type. So you can, the same genotype, for example, you can find both in North America, Europe and Japan, but it will always be like freshwater pond or concrete statue or things like that. People for a very long time, scientists thought that within this Klebsormediophysi there are only simple filaments, and quite recently the genus Streptosarcina was described, where we already see some beginning of branching, which is from the evolutionary point of view quite an important step, because before we thought that branching is something typical for this most developed form, for this ZCC clay and not the KCM clay, and now we see that branching already appears within some members of the Klebsormediophysi. So now we are already within the clade ZCC. So these are the most developed streptophytes that are really quite similar in many ways to the land plants. As I told you, not similar in their morphology, but in their metabolics, biochemistry, and some other molecular traits, let's say. First of them is this Coleochaetophysi class. It's again quite a small class, with only, I think, one genus and several species. And it's a freshwater species, but it has a typical ecology. It forms these discs. It's like a multicellular disc. There is just one layer of cells. And it grows attached to some water plants, submerged plants. So here we see just the talus of Coleochaeta. And here we can see it growing on the grass, or not grass, or the leaf of some water plants. In this group or genus, it's important that they already have oogamy. It's like the most developed form of sexual reproduction, that they have developed this different female and male gametangia, they have oogonium and anteridium, they have spermatozoids, and when they form a zygote, the zygote forms a very resistant spore that can survive many different stresses, which is something we will see also later in the groups. And you know that in land plants there is already also oogamy, so this is one of the more developed traits. Then we have the class Charophysi. Charophyce, maybe you know them or heard about them. Charophyce are algae with the most morphologically most developed talus. So before people made any molecular analysis, they thought that these are actually the closest relative of land plants, because they already look a little like plants. They have something like roots and stems and leaves, and they are big, and they morphologically also resemble some water plants. If you know any higher plants living in water, they very often have this morphology of the leaves. I don't know the word to describe it, but yeah, the tiny and narrow leaves in these like corals. It's a trait that appears very often within water plants from different classes and different families, because it's just an adaptation to the life in water. So you can very easily mistake it for a water plant, but it's an alga. It has no real organs, no real no real roots, and so on. It only looks similar to them. We have different genera, Charanitella, for example, and we can find them in clear water, which is not very acidic. They don't like acidic water, and they like clear water. And so here is their life cycle. It's nothing you have to learn in detail, just to show you that they actually also have this oogamy. So we have a plant like this, and on the plant then we have developed oogonia and antenidia, so different sexual organs for male and female gametes. So this one is female and this one is male. So if you find the plant of Chara during the vegetation season, it will be covered by these balls, let's say, and the round, small round orange or red balls are these antheridia, and within these antheridia the spermatozoids are formed. And I just wanted to show you this very strange form or shape of male gamete, made spermatozoid. You know, this is the cell, and here are the two flagella, and they are not growing from the back of the cell, but from this place. So it's just a very, very typical form of a female from the male spermatozoid. And within this organ, this is the female gametangium called oogonium. So inside the female gametes are formed, then we have the fertilization process where the spermatozoid swims to the female gametangium. And the important thing is that after the fertilization, they also form a very resistant spore-like cell, which is covered with very thick and specialized cell wall, and it can survive many, many years in sediments and so on. And it can even fossilize. So for some paleobiologists, these very old fossilized spores of Chara are also important marker of presence of some lakes and so on. But if it doesn't fossilize, if it normally survives, then it can form the next season another plant, another cara. This is just a cross section of the rhizoids. We may not call these things roots because they are not the real roots. They are just because root of a plant. If we have a normal higher plant and it has roots, so the purpose of the roots is to the uptake of some nutrients and water and so on. And it's not the case of Chara. It's the purpose of the rhizoids here is only to hold the plant within the substrate. So they are not real roots. They are just rhizoids. And it was found that within these rhizoids there are some statolites, some like little crystals that are like heavy. So it's the same similar principles as in the roots of the higher plants. So these statolites give the plant the signal of the gravity. So they give it the signal of what is up and what is down. So they basically form the direction of the growth towards the earth, you know, caused by the gravity. Carophyci are so if we look at the whole group of streptophytes or the algae within streptophytes, I repeatedly told you that they are freshwater or terrestrial in contrast to the chlorophyta, which were mostly marine or originally marine. This is true, but some of the Carophyci secondarily came back to the sea, to the marine water, but not to the real salty marine water. They only can survive brackish water, which means marine environment, but with only a little amount of salt. So they are, for example, typical for the Baltic Sea. I don't actually know from which countries you are, so if you is anyone here from Germany or okay, sorry. So I don't know if you're familiar with Baltic Sea or not, but the typical thing for Baltic Sea is that there is only this quite narrow connection with the world ocean, with Northern Sea and Atlantic Ocean. So this is just the only source of salty water from the ocean. But on the other hand, you have a lot of rivers coming into the Baltic Sea and bringing fresh water, which means that there is quite a high gradient of salinity from the here you have this this place. So there is the normal salt amount of the North Sea here, and you see that very quickly it changes to almost fresh water here in the Gulf of Botnia. So it's also interesting for some ecological studies that you can you have a lot of studies describing diversity, changing of diversity of different organisms on this natural salinity gradient. And this is something which is good for the Carophyci. Baltic Sea also has a lot of very shallow lagoons where they are also protected from high waves and so on. And there is just a very shallow water and mud and no high waves and no real big difference between the tides. And these places are really ideal for Carophyci. So if you would describe the vegetation of many great regions of the sea bottom of Baltic Sea, you would find that it's really dominated by Carophyci. Oh, I see. I thought I have not this slide here, but I do. So this is just, as I told you, about the fossilization of these oospores. So this is how they look like when you find them in some old sediment. So they are really like stones. They are hard and black. And this is a picture from the electron microscope. So just to give you the impression that they have very thick, rigid cell walls and they can fossilize. And the paleobiologists call these things gyrogonites. So they originally maybe they did not even know that it's connected with this Chara, but they just found it always in the old sediments. And actually there is a whole there are many papers dealing with these very old gyrogonites. Maybe there are even more papers about this than about recent Charophysi. And there are even books with different types, you know, which were described from the past sediments, and that we don't have now, have them now. So definitely there also in this class Charophysi there once was much higher diversity of the species than remained until recent, which we see on these paleogyrogonites, that we have many, many different forms found in the sediments, much more than we have from present Charophysi. And it's a good thing, because from the other classes we don't have, well, in general it's difficult for algae to have real fossils, something really hard that can be fossilized and can be found in the sediment. So we in most classes of algae we or other protist organisms we have no idea about the past diversity, and we can only assume that, for example, the diversity was bigger than now. And here we have the proof, like with seeing it in the morphology of gyrogonite. Good. And let's come now to the last class of algae. So it's the last class of algae we are going to talk about in here, and the next thing will already be about some higher plants. So this is called Sigmatophyci, or they are called conjugating green algae. They are very simple, you know, they are either unicellular or filamentous. So, as I told you, people always thought that the closest relatives of plants are in fact Charophysi, because of their complicated morphology. And it was really a surprise when many molecular studies confirmed that the closest relatives of plants are these quite simple Sigmatophyci. But it seems that it will remain like that, because many different studies confirmed this. They are called conjugating green algae because of conjugation. It's a typical sexual reproduction. They actually don't have any flagellate stages. As I told you already, in red algae rhodophytes, they also did not have any flagellate stages. This is something that is still quite a special thing among organisms, because usually at least one stage in a life cycle contains some flagella, and still some groups lost flagellate stages at all, including these Sigmatophyci. So they don't have typical male gamete with flagella. So how do they do their sexual reproduction? The conjugation means that this is the example with a filamentous member with spirogyra, and we have cells from different filaments coming close to one another, and they form a conjugation tube between let's start here. We just have two different filaments, then they come close together and they start to form these bulbs, and then they fuse and form a conjugation tube. And then the living content of the whole vegetative cell, it's called protoplast, it acts like a gamete, and it crawls to the conjugation channel and fuses with the other one, and then they form a zygote. So we don't need any flagellate stages because they don't go outside, they don't go to the water, they don't need to swim around and find the partner, because the cells fuse with this, the cells conjugate and the protoplast fuse within the cell walls of the cell. Again, after the formation of the zygote develops a zygospores. Again, very resistant spore with very thick cell wall, with different layers of the cell wall that can withstand desiccation and UV radiation and whatever, and survive in some sediments when the conditions are not very nice, so they can survive until the conditions are again good. So they don't have the oogamy, it's isogamy, but still they form these resistant spores called zygospores. This is okay, I will talk about this later. Now, about some members, I think you already saw this picture, or even maybe the real alga. This is called Spirogyra. It's one of the most common algae. I mean, even in school, when kids look at something in microscope, very, very often this is used as an example of algae or whatever, because it looks very interesting with this spiral shaped chloroplast, and it's easy to observe. They have big cells and they have this spiral shaped chloroplast. Here we see the sexual reproduction, that we have two filaments forming these conjugation tubes in between all the pairs of cells, and here we already have some zygotes. Another relative species to Spirogyra is Zygnema, which has two star-shaped chloroplasts in the cell, so it's also quite a nice guy to show during some microscopy sessions. And these are basically freshwater, living in even in some ponds, but even in some pools like this that are very shallow and sometimes desiccate and so on. So if you go for a walk somewhere and you see wet places, very shallow wet places like this, which are covered by some greenish mucilaginous stuff like this, they are very often or most common members of these filamentous Zygnematophyci. Maybe different genera, but Zygnematophyci. There are some special adaptations that we can find in Zygnematophyce. I think I like this algae. They are quite interesting. That's why I talk about them in here, because they are living on ice. I don't know if you remember from the last time I told you about snow algae, about this Chlamydomonas nivalis living on snow. And I will just try to explain the difference between snow and ice, because you might think it's basically the same environment, but it is not. Because the snow algae, they developed on the snow fields, and they are only seasonal. They melt, and then during the summer there is normal soil, and they can live in soil where they have a lot of nutrients and other things. But these live on the surface of glaciers that are there the whole year round. So the environment is much more stressful, and they have much less nutrients and so on. And it's interesting that only members of some two or three species, I think they are, but always from this class, Zygnematophyce, grow on the surface of the glaciers. So no chlorophyte algae, no Chlamydomonas nivalis, but it is Zygnematophyce. One of their special adaptations they have is that they contain these phenolics, brown colored phenolics, that give them also some protection against the radiation. But why I am talking about them is that they really actually have a global impact on a global climate and so on. Because as they develop on the surface on the glaciers, there is so much of them that they are dark colored, so they change the color of the glaciers to darker. And it reduces the albedo, it reduces the amount of energy that is reflected from the ice, and it actually makes the ice, the surface of the glacier, melt faster. And the faster the glacier melts, the more water you have, and that's good for the algae. So they developed more when they have liquid water and not just snow and ice. So it's like a positive loop, that the more algae you have, the more fast glacier melts, and it makes the algae develop more. So there are many papers about it in Nature and Science. You know, it's quite an important topic for people who study the climate change and the melting of the glaciers. And it seems that the algae living there are really an important factor in promoting the melting of the glaciers. But if we talk about Zygnematophyce, we must not forget about desmids. These are special. This is one, like one group within Zygnematophyce, and these are unicellular algae with many different shapes and forms, and in many languages, including German and including Czech, the traditional name of this group reflects their beauty. Let's say they are called like beautiful algae, and it's because they have always they have big cells and always symmetrical with different shapes. And ecologically we can say that for them it's typical that they occur in acidic oligotrophic marshes, like peat bogs. So if you come to any peat bog and take a sample, it will be always dominated by these desmids. So this is just an example of different species or different genera that they can, and it's always one cell, you know, like this is also one cell, but always have two symmetrical halves. So this is the genus Microsterias, it means like little star, these are like a little moon-shaped Closterium, this is Xanthidium, Cosmarium, so you don't have to remember the names of the genera, it's just for you to show the variety of forms that we find within Desmids. Good, and now, this is the end of the let's say taxonomical part, taxonomical introduction to the different classes of algae, and now I would like to talk, let's say maybe shortly, only about the terrestrialization of land plants, because we saw many different classes and groups of algae. And then you will talk for the rest of the semester about the land plants. But there must have occurred this event of the successful terrestrialization, successful coming to the land by the ancestor of the land plants. And we can say that it was a really important event in the Earth's history, because it really changes the planet, you know. And it's really interesting to consider that, for example, if you look into the sea, on what grows on the sea bottom, it's never dominated by one single group. You have, for example, this big macro algae, but you have red algae, green algae, and also the brown algae, which we were not talking about at all, because they belong to a absolutely different different group of organisms. But there are many, many different groups that specialized on this marine environment. But there was no other group of all other phototrophic organisms that would be able to dominate life on land, only these plants, the embryophytes. So it's an interesting question, what makes them so successful? Because I already gave you examples of many terrestrial algae from different lineages, like the Strentopolia, the orange stuff on tree bark, and whatever. So there are many algae that are able to live on land, but none of them gave rise to a big group that would dominate everything, that would form trees and herbs and so on. They always remain tiny filamentous or unicellulars, restricted to some special environments. So they must have some special traits that enable them to do so. And it's actually nowadays it's one of the hot topics in botany. So we have many papers studying this, also from the point of view of some genomics and transcriptomics and so on. So people try to understand what made the land plants so successful, and what were the traits typical for the last common ancestor of the land plants and the algae. Okay, this is just a tree showing where the habitats where we find the members, but I think this is something I already mentioned during when I was talking about the different classes. Here we have the Chlorophyta, which is originally marine, but invaded also freshwater and terrestrial environment, And these are all streptophytes, and they are originally, as I said, freshwater. In different classes, we have this red color dot, which shows that they entered terrestrial environments, and only within Charophyce, as I told you, we have some that some of them go back to the brackish sea, but not really to the marine water. This is a tree that you really don't need to study and learn in detail, but it's just, if you were interested in this topic, you can go through all these things written in here, and even I recommend reading of this paper. It's a genomics paper, so it's not easy to comprehend, maybe, but it's a very nice there is a lot of information about the evolution of individual traits. So here you can see the evolution. We have chlorophytes, and then the individual classes of streptophytes, and individual groups of embryophytes as well. And very nicely, you can see the evolution of different traits, even morphological, but also some biochemical, and so on. And you see when they appeared, and also where they were lost. For example, in Zygnematophyce, I told you that they are in many ways they are quite simple, and that it's quite surprising that Zygnematophyce are or should be the closest relatives to the land plants. But it's because we think we believe that many of these complicated traits were secondarily lost. That their ancestor has them, like the oogamy or some flagellate stages, and they were secondarily lost, maybe because this group specialized to live in these marshes, and for them it was easier to have a very simple morphology, and they developed this conjugation and so on, and they didn't need these developed traits that some relatives do. Yeah, actually, this is the very first paper that showed that, where is it? This clade represented by Spirogyra and Closterium. These are actually Zygnematophyce, and this was the very first paper that stated that Zygnematophyce are the closest relatives to the land plants. And since 2011, other papers just only confirmed this. But I don't know why I'm showing it here. I should have shown you before, but sorry for that confusion. And this is a paper, it's a phylotranscriptomic analysis, so it's a really big data analysis, and they still confirm the position of Zygnematophyce as a sister group to the land plants. This is already quite an old paper, but I really like the story described in it. Even though it might not be completely true, you know, as I always repeat, it's just a hypothesis, but it's a very nice hypothesis. And it shows the... It's an attempt to explain the evolution within these groups of green, of the green group. It's here it's about the split of Chlorophyta and Streptophyta, and it says that in some ancient times, a billion years ago, the ancestor of chlorophytes developed in the ocean, and the ancestor of streptophytes developed in fresh water, and both were successful in their own environment. This is something I already told you before. But later, let's start here, you know, the picture starts at the bottom and it goes up here. So let's look on this picture B, like here. And then they hypothesize that probably that both groups were successful and absolutely divided in different environment. But then some chlorophytes, or maybe just one, the ancestor of all these freshwater chlorophytes, so they secondarily came to freshwater. So some of these chlorophytes that were originally marine learned to live in freshwater and came there. And that it was probably a big problem for the streptophytes, that they were not able to withstand the competition with these newly coming chlorophytes. And that this event mainly meant that a lot of them went extinct, and maybe this is also the cause of why they are why there is not such a big diversity within the streptophytic algae, because some chlorophyte algae came in and outcompeted them. So for the streptophytes, there were who wanted to survive in this invasion, there were not many possibilities what to do. And the only group from streptophytes, recent streptophytes, that is really successful and species rich are the zygnematophyci. And the authors hypothesize that it's because they escaped to this peat box, to these acidic oligotrophic marshes that are in many ways can be considered like extreme environments, and no, not everyone can survive in there, but they just escaped normal freshwater to this box, and they started to evolve, and now they have many species and many many different forms, and became a successful group and escaped this chlorophytic invasion. And another possibility what to do, how to survive, was to colonize land. And this is what the ancestor of the embryophytes did, that they escaped to the land. And now, when we look at freshwater, normal freshwater habitats like ponds and rivers, so most green algae that we find them are actually chlorophyta, not streptophyta, even though originally these habitats were dominated by streptophyta, but they were outcompeted by the stronger chlorophytes that even only secondarily came there from the sea. Was this clear, or maybe you can just read this, or you can even read this paper. It's quite a short paper, and it's with many of these pictures, so I think it's very easy to understand. Yeah, this basically shows the same that where these members of the individual classes used to live. But what is interesting is this paper, this Harhold paper, because it comes with a totally new hypothesis. And interestingly, some future, it's from 2015, and even some later papers, even some genomics paper and so on, they like this hypothesis and they confirm it in many ways. And It says, if I think even the name of this paper is that the title is Plants Were Terrestrial from the Beginning. And it actually says that the ancestor of all the spore streptophytes was terrestrial. And if we have some streptophytic groups that are strictly freshwater or water plants like these Scarophyceae, it's actually their secondary return to freshwater, but or some freshwater desmids and so on. But they say that streptophytes originally were on land. As I told you about these genomic studies, so they sometimes confirm that they find genes that are typical for living on land, even in the primitive freshwater streptophytes. So that's how they explain it, that this adaptation was there actually already from the beginning. Yeah, this is another nice picture. I like these papers because they always have these nice pictures, but we don't have to talk in detail about it. What is important is this thing, because we always think about terrestrialization in connection with some stresses that the plants had to withstand. And we see that there is high irradiance and there is desiccation and other similar stresses that are important on land. And it's clear that the ancestor of the land plants must have mechanisms to survive these stresses. But on the other hand, also these unicellular or filamentous algae that live on terrace or tree bark or whatever, they also have to withstand this. So this is not a real explanation why the plants were so successful and what helped them to create the big bodies and trees and so on. And there is one hypothesis which is now also quite supported, and it's the interaction with fungi or other organisms, but mostly with fungi. So I don't know if you heard about this symbiosis between higher plants and fungi, but it seems that this is maybe the crucial part that really helped the ancestor of the land plants to colonize land and to develop bigger bodies, that they have this symbiosis with this fungi. This symbiosis was only confirmed with in land plants, but in these members of this ZCC clade, we don't have any similar interaction with fungi. But we already have some genes in the genome that later turned out to be important for the development of this mycorrhizal symbiosis. So we can see it as a pre-adaptation in the genome for this future symbiosis that helped them really to conquer land. So, very briefly about bryophytes, which is the first group of embryophyta, first group of land plants that we are going to talk about. I have to admit that I am a phycologist. I mean, I am specialized in algae, so I am not really specialized in mosses. I have to teach you about them, but this is not my field of study, so that's why I will just only talk about them for 10 minutes, and I hope you won't mind. But for me it's much easier and interesting to talk more about algae and less time about bryophytes. So I am sorry about that. I am sure that some other colleagues would would talk interesting stories about mosses for 2 hours, but I just can't. So this is maybe important, and this is something you might go through when learning for the exam. So when I use the term land plants, it's actually the same as this embryophyta. And embryophyta, it's bryophytes and so-called higher plants, which means you have these two different terms, land plants and higher plants, and it's not the same, because you have these bryophytes, which are something in between, you know. So there are some traits typical for all embryophytes, but if we are now talking only about bryophyta, then they have some typical traits that make them different from the higher plants, so different from the rest of the plants we are going to talk about with my colleague. So the most important thing maybe for you to learn is this dominance of gametophyte, because as I already told you, these life cycles are maybe not very popular with the students, but they are important for understanding of plant evolution, so we are going to ask about them also during the exam. And if you remember, the general life cycle was that you have haploid phase and diploid phase, and you have fertilization and meiosis. And in algae, you had we saw different forms of this life cycle. And if we look at bryophytes and the all next groups, we will see a shift from dominant gametophyte to absolutely dominant sporophyte in gymnosperms and angiosperm groups. So bryophytes are actually the only group of land plants which has dominant gametophyte, which means that the longest part, the main part of the life cycle, they are gametophyte, they are haploid. What it is? It's the green plant, the green moss that you find in a forest or wherever. Like this. These are all gametophytes. This plant are haploid, you know? And we have two different sex, so we have female gametophyte and male gametophyte. And when time comes, then on the top of this gametophyte, the sexual organs developed archegonium and anteridium. We have sperm cells with flagella, so they need some moisture from rain and so on. So the sperms can move from male anteridium towards the female archegonium. And then there is fertilization, formation of the embryo. And then from the top of this green gametophyte plant, a sporophyte grows. So only this part, this usually in mosses, the brown part that grows on the top of the gametophyte, it's diploid, it's sporophyte, because then there is meiosis, and the spores that are released from sporophyte are again haploid. So in this case, we call it that the sporophyte is grows dependent on the gametophyte. It cannot grow on its own. It's on grows from the top of the green plant, which is gametophyte. So dominant part of the life cycle is gametophyte, and streptophyte is dependent on gametophyte. So this is maybe the most important information about bryophytes for you to remember. This is just to show you that there are also, maybe it's not really resolved, but this is a study that shows that bryophyta are or should be really a monophyletic lineage within plants, and they have three main lineages: mosses, liverworts, and hornworts. So I use the term bryophyta. I think that in English we don't have two different words. In Czech we do, like, a word that describes this group, this whole group, like bryophyta sensulato, and then we have mosses, which can be called bryophyta sensu stricto, and these liverworts or marchantiophyta and hornworts, antocerotophyta. So let's start with the hornworts. I don't really want to talk much in detail about them, just for you to know that they exist. So they have very simple talus, just this very leafy, they don't have like stem and leaves, they just with these little lobes, you know, and these horns. That's why they are called hornworts. These horns are already the sporophytic phase, and it's in hornworts the sporophytes are green. They are able of photosynthesis, so which is something we don't see in liverworts and mosses. It's just within hornworts that even the sporophyte is green and photosynthetic. Then we have marchantiophytes, marchantiophyta or liverwort. During the practicals I will show you also some examples. This is Marchantia polymorpha with very, very interesting morphology. It forms these little umbrellas, but you know, these are not sporophytes actually. You might think that these umbrellas are the sporophytes, but they are not. They are just some, how shall I call it, some supporting formations on which the Archegonia or Antheridia grow, you know, and the sporophyte itself is very very small and short. Where is it here on the picture actually? Where we have the sporophyte? Now I'm also lost, like, here we have a zygote, yes. Yeah, like, yeah, this is actually sporophyte. It's like small structure going out of this umbrella, you know. So this is the zygote, and from this zygote a very small structure like this grows. So it would be like small structure growing down from this umbrella would be a sporophyte, and only this, and then the spores which are released from it are already haploid. In Marchantiophyta, here it is. I thought that I must have a picture, and it's on the next slide. So this is the detail of an umbrella of Marchantia, which is still haploid, the umbrella structure, and here we have the small sporophyte. So only this, and in Martian Sciophyta they always have the only hyaline stalk. So it's quite ephemeral, very short living stage, which forms the diploid phase of the liverworts. These are some examples of different liverworts. Some of them have this structure with sort of stem and leaves, and some of them are just these lobes. And now we can talk shortly about mosses. So it's like Bryophyta sensu stricto. So this is the life cycle I showed you at the beginning, and it actually applies to mosses, to Bryophyta sensu stricto. The very first phase that grows from the haploid spores before this plant is formed is called protonema, and it might remind you just of a filamentous algae. It's simple filaments with branching filaments, and it grows for some time only in this form, and then later it forms the real green plant, green body of a moss. Here we see the sporophyte. So in contrast to liverworts, the sporophyte is quite long living, and it's like usually brown and quite rigid, and it has two parts called food stalk and capsule, and within the capsule the spores are formed. Here you can see just the variation of different forms, which is important for the species description. It's not that important. Yeah. Okay. Some of mosses are able of asexual reproduction, so they produce so-called gamete. So these are little pieces of the talus, let's say, that are used for the asexual reproduction. So this is like only a few cell long filaments that can be transported by wind and so on. And I think two more slides only. No, three. I will be quick, I promise. This is just an example of different places where mosses can be found, because usually when we think about mosses, we think they just live in a forest on some wet ground and so on. But we have mosses that are specialized for very dry and sunny places, like even roofs and some concrete walls. We have some growing on the branches or on the tree. This Fontinalis is typical submerged moss in some streams. And we have even some really specific places where we can find mosses, like this Splachnum that lives on excrements of animals. If we talk about mosses, we should not forget to talk about Sphagnum, because it's a habitat forming genus of ecologically very important habitat called peat bogs. I already mentioned these desmids, the algae that live specifically in peat bogs. So I guess you have maybe heard about Sphagnum. Sphagnum is able to absorb water in their cells, and they can, when they grow, their biomass is not rotten, but it's stuck in the lower layers, submerged in water. So after many years or thousands of years, a peat is formed, and maybe you know peat as that it was used for burning, you know, as instead of coal and so on. But it's also ecologically very important because it's a sink of carbon from the atmosphere. That it's the carbon is during the photosynthesis, it's transferred into the biomass, but the biomass stays within the sediment. It does not enter atmosphere again. So it's a big sink of carbon, and it's basically typical for the like northern part of like for this boreal climate, and we have vast regions in Canada and Siberia and so on that are mostly covered by these peat bogs. And when the climate changes and there is not enough water and they desiccate, then a lot of carbon which was sedimented there for thousands of years can be released back to the atmosphere. So that's why these marshes, these sphagnum marshes, are studied intensively. This is the very last slide, just with some examples of utilization of bryophytes, and there is not many of it actually. They are not really used intensively for any biotechnology or medicine and so on, so they are only few examples that we can find, and actually the most important thing is the peat production from sphagnum. Okay, so thank you very much. Sorry for being a little late.